Okay, this is tape number one with Jane Banfield. Jane, would you just like to start out cold, talking about what you can remember of UBC?
I came to UBC first in 1948. Of course, I'd seen it a lot before that. I mean, before I actually arrived on the campus, I'd often been out to visit it. But of course, it was a great experience to be a student, especially because there were so many students. I think there were about 10,000, perhaps 9 or 10,000. And most of them were veterans. And they added a particular spice to the campus. In fact, I'm forever grateful to one particular veteran whose name I have never remembered, without whose efforts I should never have gotten through Geography 101, I think it was, which consisted largely, it seemed, of mapping the trails around where the Totem Park now is. And I hadn't the faintest idea about anything. And mapping was beyond me, but he certainly helped me a great deal. I'm forever in his debt. But I remember being rather annoyed that professors often said that the students like myself, who were not veterans, who came in fresh from the high schools, were not very good students, that we didn't want to learn as much or learn as fast or, study as much as the veterans. And I remember being slightly piqued that, this sort of criticism should have been leveled at us. After all, we didn't ask to be born who we were. We didn't ask not to be veterans. I remember the Jokers Club, because they were great fun. They were always up to outlandish things. I wish I could remember some of the things they did do.
Could you explain what the Jokers Club
was? Well, the Jokers Club was really, as its name implies, a very informal kind of group of veterans whose main aim in life was to make life a little livelier. And I suppose you might say they played pranks. No, something more serious than that, perhaps. I think they had a great deal of satire in their makeup. Certainly, they used to campaign for various causes, good and otherwise, around the campus, and they gave it a kind of lightness of tone. They could always be counted on to turn up on rather serious occasions and remind us that not everything should be taken with a great deal of levity. And I remember, too, that they once had, outside the Student Council building, the AMS office, Brock Hall, once had a teepee erected for some reason or other, in which a number of them lived for some days on pork and beans or something for some worthy cause. But they were always to be found around the campuses, and I say, liven things up immensely. And I remember the huts everywhere, of course. We all took classes in them, and all our extracurricular activities were in huts. And they were pretty battered, even by 1948, I must say. I especially remember the huts at Fort Camp, where, although I lived at home, I had many friends who were, in fact, living in residence at Fort Camp. And I remember how very convivial it was, and there were very few regulations about the coming and going of students. And there were quite an interesting group of people there, some of whom I've kept in touch with, many of whom I haven't, who were very interested in the arts and the theater, who were very active on the campus and downtown, who were running little magazines and doing all kinds of rather interesting oddments, painting, and especially amateur theater. I remember Dorothy Somerset's productions, taking raw amateurs such as myself and producing things like Toller's Masses in Man and The Ascent of F6 by Isherwood and Arden. I remember things of this kind, and I especially remember this very convivial feeling, which I think was really an effect of having veterans there, which gave it a great deal more richness and variety than any of us could have done ourselves, being as we were 18-year-olds who had, frankly, as I realized later, seen very little of the world or very much of life. So I think that I was very lucky in a way to have been on the campus when it was not only huge, but at the same time lively, because there was a kind of center for much student activity. Certainly the CAF, which I remember very well, of course, and Brock Hall, and Fort Camp. These strike me now, at least in my, now looking back, personal recollections, as being the very lively centers. And it was a very Catholic, small-c Catholic group from many parts of Canada who were interested in making their life at UBC, their academic life, far richer than I would have ever have imagined life would have been in a university. I enjoyed it immensely because of these people. I think this is why. I remember, too, the enormous crowds that used to go to the field house to listen to the noon lectures, and we all took the paper bags with sandwiches and listened to various people. I remember Nehru speaking there, vociferous audience. I remember an even more vociferous audience listening to Tim Buck, when a number of items, dead and alive, were thrown on the stage. I can remember, too, that Those meetings must have been very difficult for any speaker to face. Having now faced students, I realize that to face 2,000 or 3,000 students with their paper bags and eating at the same time, and tried, as it were, to control the meeting, as well as get your point across, must have been awfully difficult. But they were great fun, and I remember, too, that it must have been a measure of the administration's view about the student council, that its activities certainly were not restrained, so far as I could ever see, by the administration. They were always very active, of course, in building things, in building not only Brock Hall, but later on the gym. They were a very active force, and since we paid so much in the way of fees, they had their hands on a fair amount of money. And I remember at one stage or other, I think it was the second year I was at UBC in 1949, it wasn't exactly a scandal, I wouldn't call it that, but a certain amount of mismanagement by the Student Council of its funds, simply, I should have thought, because there's so much money involved and so little experience, quite simply that. I later was a member of the Students' Council. I was vice president. And it was very interesting. Student Council meetings are very fractious. The Students' Council was not only a very powerful body vis-a-vis the administration, and I think often listened to with a great deal of respect. Well, it had to be, because it did represent such a lot of students and a lot of money. But it was also a very fractious body internally. It was pretty, the meetings were very lively, always. I served as vice president under the first Asian, first, I suppose, non-European, non-Canadian ever to be elected president, Ragbir Basu, who is now teaching in the United States.
Where's he from?
He was from India, came as a student, but never returned permanently anyway. And what do I remember else? I remember the long drive, long marine drive every morning about 8 o'clock, the great trail of cars, the car chain so carefully arranged so that we would all get out at 8:29 for an 8:30 lecture. And I remember especially in autumn the plane trees, I think there were plane trees, that stretched between the main mall and Brock Hall. I remember how lovely they were in the autumn when they started to turn yellow. There were very few trees that did on the campus. And there was something about the air around those trees which had a very pleasing quality to me. I've always remembered that with great affection. It's surprising because the campus had many other points of beauty. But I remember those plane trees yellowing in the sort of rather damp air of September and October. It seemed to me that that particular smell, of course, was the token of the beginning of another school year. And I remember, too, UBC when I came back to it, having spent a year away at McGill. I came back to UBC to go into law, and this meant, of course, that I was removed from much of the activity which I had hitherto taken part in, because the law school was way off and went into the campus, and because we were all very busy studying, or at least we were supposed to be. And I remember being struck again by the particular flavor of UBC as compared to McGill, that it was living in this peculiar isolation at the end of this enormous peninsula, separated by, in some cases, this sort of virgin forest from the city, how far removed it was from the city center, how self-centered in some ways a community it was. But I also remember remarking again on the vitality of the student activities at UBC, which one just didn't find at McGill. I think, I don't know why this should have been so. Perhaps it was because McGill was in the middle of Montreal, and there were so many other things for the students to do. I mean, our pleasures at McGill were certainly very different from those, and our activities very different from those of UBC. And yet I remember UBC as being terribly lively then, coming back with and realizing with a surprise there was a great deal going on, an almost rambunctious student council, because I was very interested in student politics. A very marked spirit of independence among students on the whole, vis-a-vis the professors to some extent, because there were still a lot of returned veterans in my law class, much older than many of us. And just a lot of student activities. The newspaper was always full of so many thousand things going on, and you wanted to be involved in a good many more than you could. So that these are the things perhaps I remember, the veterans, the Jokers Club, which was part of the whole veterans movement, the huts everywhere, the liveliness of the student life, the independence of the student body, as the AMS, and this peculiar isolation from the city, so that you felt that you were living a life which was quite separate and distinct and different from anything that any of your other colleagues or friends lived, and yet which at the same time, thanks to the veterans, was much less inbred than I think a good many other campuses were. And there was always a great deal of the feeling of growth and the feeling of which I think one finds in B.C. generally, you know, sort of, damn the east, full speed ahead. Mm-hmm. And this I noticed again, especially when I came back from McGill.
What do you think, you know, I really haven't had a chance to ask anybody about the international students, and I think we should say something about them, the ones from all over, and how they compared. How many were at McGill? Well, there seems to be an awful lot from everywhere, but I think we must have gotten a larger quota from the West Indies than most of them because of the climate.
Mm. Oh, I think this was true. I suppose that next to McGill, which has always had foreign students, simply because McGill has had that reputation for years. And so when a foreign doctor graduates and goes back to his own country, his fellow students think, where should we go? And they've heard of is McGill. But I think it's true that UBC probably got the second largest share, proportionately, of foreign students. Certainly a lot of them came from the West Indies. There were quite a few South Americans, as I recall, as well. Number of Chinese from Hong Kong. Quite a number from India and Pakistan. A very few, I would think, from Europe, really. A very, very few from Africa. Very few indeed. The only one I can remember was an Ethiopian who is now the director of the Bank of Ethiopia. I wish I could remember his name. Tafara de Guefe. Who married a UBC girl, I think. He married a Canadian. I think she was a UBC girl. In any case, there were very few of them. But there was an international students' club, of course. It lived in one of the huts. And there was a certain amount of activity. Those of us who were involved in the United Nations Club, often perforce, were also involved in the International Students Organization of one thing or another. And there were a lot of sort of international student weeks, because all of this was sponsored, in a sense, by the Students' Council, who were very interested. And the Students' Council took very great and continuing interest in organizations such as World University Service, and, of course, in what is now the Canadian Union of Students. There was, at that time, was NIFCUS, the National Federation of Canadian University Students. So there was a feeling, too, that UBC had shaken off the isolation of the 30s, certainly, because there were a lot of foreign students. And there was certainly a lot of activity in the residences where the foreign students mainly lived. Although it always struck me at UBC that it was a very great, lively life in the boarding houses outside the gate. And constant, I remember also, of course, one was traveling in a car chain, one always was almost duty-bound to squeeze in another person as one traveled, especially along the main mall, going out to the gates, because there were thousands of people always hitchhiking. I remember once hitchhiking, being picked up by the Union of Women, who didn't think it was a very good idea for women students to be hitchhiking. I don't know whether she'd stopped out of pity for me or whether she stopped just to give me this message.
Should we say something about the fraternities and sororities? Because you're the first undergraduate and graduate I've ever, you know, so far. I've only done Mackenzie, and you're people like your father.
Well, would you like to? Well, I joined a sorority my second year, because, of course, the sororities were very carefully controlled by the Dean of Women, and so you couldn't join one until you were in your second year, which I think is not a bad idea. And they had, really, was it sort of an odd status, as I recall. They weren't officially recognized. Certainly they weren't allowed to have houses or anything of this kind on the campus property. One or two, I think, did have houses which they more or less rented, in which the members stayed. And there, of course, there were the weekly meetings, and there was, of course, the table in the caf, all of which was a very informal arrangement. And I suppose that's really where the sororities, since, in fact, their activities are rather confined because of this rule, I suppose the caf was where most of their activities took place. Of course, they had the annual dance, and goodness knows, one went to seen with around to so many annual dances. You know, when I think back, the faded pictures now at the K with the bottles under the table.
And the Commodore
in places like this. Oh, Lord. Those incredible dresses, of course, the huge corsages and the engineer's ball and all these things. And later, of course, the lawyer's ball, which was always a bit of a wild and woolly shindig. But the sororities never... I was never, to be very frank, a very enthusiastic member of a sorority, because I was very much involved in a good many other things which held my interest longer than the sorority did. So I don't think that I could have said that I was a very enthusiastic or even a very good member of a sorority. And I left in my third year to go to McGill. My sorority had no chapter there, so that I was, again, sort of a free agent. And when I came back, it was to law school, and I more or less severed my ties with the sorority. I had to sever my ties with a good many organizations. I just didn't have time. And I had to choose, and I chose to keep up my ties with the Students' Council rather than with the sorority. But it was an interesting, it was obviously a part of UBC life for the undergraduate, especially the tables and the calf, bedlam, reigned. When I think of it now, I never had anything that could resemble peace and quiet for the lunches and the lineups. And of course, the calf was so small. The tables all seemed to be zinc-lined, like something from an old Paris bar. The food left so much to be desired. However, it was certainly part of undergraduate life.
I could probably get you to say now something about how UBC, because of its international students, because of its academic quality and caliber, how it's contributed to Canada and you know, what it's given to the world as a whole.
I suppose that every university's contribution to the world is, first of all, that it exists as a place where people, both professors and students, live in a kind of community which, after all, is concerned with the search for knowledge. I don't know that the search for knowledge means the search for truth. Perhaps it does. I'm not quite sure. Well, anyway, obviously, a university by its existence and by its maintenance of certain, I think, standards, both of academic teaching and of academic freedom, as far as the staff are concerned, perhaps contributes to the world just by existing. And obviously, this university has always been concerned with contributing not only this way, but also to the province of which it feels itself an integral part, and of the province of which it is, in a sense, the servant. But I think in the end run, a university must be perhaps judged by the quality of its graduates. The quality of its graduates who go on to teach themselves. I think this is very important, because much of what you teach, in a sense, or the atmosphere which you want to create when you teach, comes, of course, from your own experience. I mean, I think it's impossible, in a way, to teach unless you, without reference to your own experience. And, of course, its graduates bear witness to the quality of the teaching also in other professions, in engineering and medicine and law, in social work and library schools and everywhere else. And I think a university's reputation, therefore, and its contribution can be based very much on its graduates. What it has in the way of physical equipment, of course, is important. And the kind of emphasis it wants to put on academic research is another thing, because academic research is as important as teaching, though I don't think in our day and age, in our society, perhaps teaching has to have the major emphasis. I'm not quite sure even of this. But I think that this is the contribution that UBC must tote up, as it were, if it wants to find out where it has gone. It must look at the people like myself, like thousands of others who've gone, some of them very successfully, of course, and I think some not only successfully in terms of their own chosen profession, but successfully in terms, although one doesn't want to say university is in this business, but they've been successful because they've competed well with graduates of other universities. Perhaps this is an indication of how good a university is.
Can you think of something funny that happened, like your father did with Sedgwick?
Oh, I wish I could. Of course, my father told me this.
How about in the United Nations Club, or during those, or during a moot court, or during a model assembly, a mock assembly, or?
Oh, I wish I could remember. I was trying to when father told me about this. The only thing I can remember, which shouldn't go on the tape, was an incredible meeting between myself and one other member of the Students' Council, with four members of the administration. Well, one was a member of the administration, two were members of the administration, and two were faculty people who had also administrative posts. And the six of us sat around a table, and we were going to discuss a matter of mutual concern between the Students' Council and the administration. And we said our little piece, and there was going to be, we thought, general discussion. In fact, there was the most extraordinary display of faculty administrative bad feelings. I remember the student and I just sat back. We're both dismayed and amused at the hair-pulling that went on, the verbal hair-pulling, and sundry other things. And when I remember this with some amusement, simply because we were often accused on the Students' Council of, you know, verbal hair-pulling, if you want to put it this way, or elbowing, to the exclusion of all other worthwhile business which was before us. And the administration often suggested that we shouldn't waste our time on certain items which were bound to do nothing but raise dust or raise temperatures. But I remember this one thinking, when I heard these administrators and these professors at this meeting, good Lord, you know, even as we are they, you know. And but this was hardly amusing, although, in a sense, it had its amusing satellites. I wish I could remember one single thing.
I can't, you know.
There was something about the Joker's Club and a roll of toilet paper, which I cannot remember, which it struck me, I remember now at the time, very amusing. I can remember some of the football games between the nurses and the engineers.
Well, that's perfect. That's a good one. Yeah.
The nurses always challenge the engineers every year to a football game. I think there seemed to be someone running around the crowd with a tin hat or tin cup collecting money for some worthwhile charity. I think this was probably organized by the Jokers originally. And the nurses, girded in all kinds of, you know, a variety of paraphernalia necessary for football games, challenge the engineers. A picked team of engineers and a picked team of nurses. And, of course, it was sort of touch football. Well, it took place on the main mall at noon. Everything was closed. Traffic was all closed off. In fact, nobody who was wise would ever have driven his car or walked past the scene of action. It was incredible. I think the nurses were allowed to win occasionally, but obviously, though they fought very hard, as I recall, on many occasions, they failed to get anywhere. I remember also going to an engineer's dance at which there were a number of beautiful scale models concocted by the engineers over the year. Scale models of dams and goodness knows what all. And there was one beautiful model, which must have taken up about four card tables, of some dam, I don't know where, in British Columbia, into which somebody, towards the end of the evening, poured some very potent detergent so that when the water came through the dam over this miniature spillway, there was the most enormous sort of flood of white, fluffy soapsuds, which just couldn't be stopped. I mean, because the water was so active at the end of the spillway, you just couldn't stop the foam, which sort of went over like enormous lather over everything. I believe that this had been done, this little model had been done by the mechanical engineers. I believe, of course, the detergent had been put in by a chemical engineer or something of this kind. There was a great deal of rivalry between the engineering schools.
That's good, that one about the nurses. God, they must have gotten muddy and...
Oh, yeah, they did. I wish there was something. I wonder if there's anything else I can remember, any sort of folklore.
Yes, is there any mythology connected with UBC? There really isn't.
I can't think of anything. It would depend on...
And I've read, you know, a couple of books on the subject, trying to find... They're mostly just concerned with dry history, like Harry Logan's book.
Yeah, well, of dates and facts and figures statistics and all this sort of thing. I can't recall. There must have been terribly amusing things. I mean, as I think of it now, appalling
pep
things.
Meets. Anything in the,
Oh, there were pep meets, of course. Yes, there were pep meets. Goodness, yes, to whip up enthusiasm. Occasionally there were awful gaffes among the student council booking office, you know, when the VCF were put on with the, you know, La Cullen or Free Love Society or something in the same place at the same time with conflicting speakers. And hassles of things of this kind. I can't recall that there were any, but I can't recall...
Any professors that really impressed you? Did you take anything from Sedgwick?
I didn't take anything from Sedgwick. No, I certainly took something from Soward. Soward with the buttonhole, the wonderful rose buttonhole, very clear lectures. What I always admired and have tried to do in my own classes since was to give this sort of a marvelous sort of summary, resume of the last lecture, as it were, at the beginning of each and every lecture, resume lasting perhaps 2 or 3 minutes, which summed up in a very succinct way all that he had said. I remember the library. I remember some of the librarians. I remember how hard it was to get anything out of the library. I also remember what a privilege it was to get into the stacks. I remember the joy of going to the law school when there was nothing but open shelves, when you could do what you pleased with the books. I remember in law school once, though, that I had kicked off my shoes underneath the desk, and some of my colleagues in the school, it was a late afternoon, I remember, getting very dark, and I think I must have, like many students at that time of the day, put my head on my hands and gone to sleep, and I found that both shoes, had been removed from under the desk. This distressed me somewhat as my car chain was about to call for me at the law school. And it took for some considerable time to discover that, in fact, they were on the top of the highest bookshelf in the main reading room. To get them down required a great deal of explanation. It seemed to me that everyone had just disappeared at that moment from the vicinity of the room in which I was studying, so it was necessary to sort of make preliminary things. I also remember down in the law school basement, there was a room for the ladies. And the sign on the outer door said women. The sign on the inner door said ladies. And those of us who used the facilities were often in a quandary as to what had happened, you see, between the opening of the first door and the second, that somehow you had become reduced in status or gentility or something. Oh, and I can remember, of course, that certain of the books in the law school were very well thumbed because they had some of the most, what then seemed to us, though perhaps not now, seemed to us very racy cases of a certain kind, and that when you went to the volumes and looked at them, you would have seen that about 20 pages in the middle of this long volume were absolutely black, frequent thumbing.